Welcome to MetaStrategy's Forum on World Class IT, a weekly conversation with people who are shaping the technology landscape. I'm Peter High, and I'm pleased to welcome Jody Davids to the broadcast. Jody is the Senior Vice President and Chief Information Officer of PepsiCo, a $63 billion global food and beverage company. Since joining PepsiCo in April of 2016, Jody's led a team of over 3,000 IT professionals focused on delivering and supporting capabilities that improve business processes, enabling associates to connect and collaborate more easily, collecting and mining data for analytical insights, and enhancing performance across all aspects of PepsiCo's value chain. Prior to joining PepsiCo, Jody held the CIO role at a number of organizations, including Agrium, Best Buy, and Cardinal Health. She also serves on the board of directors of Premier Incorporated. Jody earned a bachelor's degree and an MBA from San Jose State University. I recently caught up with Jody in her office in Plano, Texas, and our conversation covered world-class IT Principle 2, infrastructure, as Jody shared how she gained experience and shared services at Cardinal Health and applied that knowledge to PepsiCo to achieve 95% improvement in service uptime, and Principle 4, IT and business partnerships, as Jody discussed how she works to empower an incredibly diverse workforce in over 200 countries. We also discussed Jody's unique career path, her perspective as a board-level CIO, and how working with Steve Jobs at Apple and Phil Knight at Nike helped her develop as a leader. Thank you for listening to the Forum on World Class IT. If you like what you hear, we'd be grateful if you'd give us a rating on iTunes or through whatever other source you use for podcasts. Thank you. The Forum on World Class IT is brought to you by TopTal, an exclusive network of the top freelance software developers, designers, and finance experts in the world. I recently caught up with TopTal CEO Tasso Duval, and he offered the following top five trends for hiring top talent.
The top five trends for hiring top talent are: 1. Hiring talent remotely, ensuring that they are able to work remotely and that companies are hiring talent remotely. 2. Leveraging teams in different dispersed locations. If you're hiring in-house and you're leveraging remotely a bit, being open to having talent even in the same time zone is an important factor that we've noticed. 3. Highly skilled teams becoming the majority rather than the lead, meaning ensuring that the team composition comprises of predominantly high-skilled labor rather than high-skilled labor supported by lower-skilled labor. 4. Infrastructure being created to support those teams, ensuring that the teams in-house are connected with the remote teams that are working together. And 5. Flexibility with offer packages. We've seen that even the in-house talent that are joining companies from Google to Facebook and on are interested in demanding that there is a remote component to their job, whether it's one day a week or full time, be included within their offer packages.
Well, Jody Davids, welcome to the Forum on World Class IT.
Thanks, Peter.
It's good to speak with you today. Jody, I thought we'd begin with your origins in IT. I mean, you've been a CIO now multiple times, currently at PepsiCo, previously at Agrium, at Best Buy, at Cardinal Health, among other major organizations that you've been a part of. And I'd love to dive into a little bit of the details of some of those experiences as well. But I know from a past conversation you and I have had, that your origins in IT are rather untraditional. You actually began your career as an executive admin and actually grew from there into the ranks of IT, counter to maybe a more traditional path from an engineering degree into a sort of a programmer and then up the ladder, so to speak. But I wonder if you could talk a little bit about those origins, that pathway into IT back in the beginning.
Sure. It was absolutely almost a serendipitous way of getting into IT. I was working at General Electric in San Jose, California at their nuclear energy business group. And I was an executive admin who happened to be supporting a group of IT people. And this was my first ever office job. I was very young at the time. I was going to college at night as a music major. And so I was at GE in this group, and one of the things that my boss asked me to do, he handed me this giant sheet of green and white bar striped paper, as we all used back in the early 80s, and asked me to do something, I can't remember even what it was, but something having to do with looking at the salaries of everybody on the page and reconciling it with some other piece of paper. And in that process, I noticed that all of the people on the page were making, you know, 2, 3, 4 times more money than I was. And so then I began to get curious about what it was they were doing, because I had always seen myself as a secretary, which my mom was, and I consider it still a really high calling. And I was a music major in school, so was expecting to do something not in corporate America. But somehow that report grabbed my attention, and I started to learn a little bit more about what these people around me did in IT. And so GE had, at that time, a really phenomenal after-hours training program that its employees could participate in. And I took a class in Fortran programming that was taught by the one woman in this group of programmers I supported. And apparently I did okay. They hired me for their next entry-level Fortran programming position, and the rest is history. But at GE, I had, it was in the early 80s, and there was an accident, Three Mile Island nuclear accident. I was working in the nuclear energy business group that sold and serviced nuclear reactors. Three Mile Island wasn't our reactor, but you can imagine that whole industry was sent into a tailspin, and eventually I was laid off at GE, which was the best thing that ever happened to me, because I emerged at Apple Computer as a programmer, and the rest is history. I stayed at Apple for 15 years.
Well, and actually, if we can linger there for a moment, since, of course, quite an interesting time that you were there, can you talk a bit about Apple in its early days and your experience there?
Oh, yeah. I was there from 82 to 97 for 15 years. And I started as a programmer working on a product called Apple III, which was later recalled from the market. So I was placed into an IT group of that was supporting finance and HR systems and worked through from there. But it was a wild time to be there. I would say it was, for me, that period was like working at three very different companies. The early days, the first Steve Jobs days before he left, just the wild, wild west. And we'd get called into his office and show him something we had done. Of course, we were running all of our IT systems then on a DEC PDP 1170, and he didn't really understand why we couldn't do it all on a Macintosh that had no network or anything around it yet. But so those were interesting conversations in those early days. But so that was the first phase of being there, just growing as a, you know, in my craft as a programmer, and then as a project manager, and then as a young manager. He left in 85, I believe, and we had John Sully come in, and that was a period where the board brought in this professional, and I'm making air quotes with my fingers, this professional executive who would help us grow up or mature as an organization, help us get more focused on process and focused on cost management and focused on all the things that large companies need to be more focused on. And so John Sully was there for a few years, and we did focus on all of those things. And then after that, John left, and we had a number of CEOs come in and go over a few-year time horizon. And when I left the organization, I thought I was leaving a dead company. It was not a great place to be. And it turns out, after, you know, reading the history book, that I was almost right. And Steve Jobs came in about a month after I left, breathed new life into the company. I still love the products to this day. I think it's a great company with great products, really focused on the design aspects and really focused on how the consumer's going to use it. I still love them.
Jody, you went from there to another icon in Nike and continued up the path of gaining greater responsibility. And I wonder if you could linger a moment on your roughly 3 years that you spent at Nike.
Yeah, I went to Nike in an intentional move to build out my resume. So at some point in my history at Apple, I had made a decision that I wanted, my career aspiration was to achieve the CIO position at a Fortune 200 company. I was that specific with myself, and in a certain time frame. And so to do this, first I did a lot of self-reflection. What do I have? What part of me is ready to be a CIO? And what do I need? What do I need to develop to truly become more viable as a candidate for a CIO opportunity? So this position at Nike was offered to me when I was at Apple, and I left there really to fill out a part of my resume and also just to get experience in another company. I had been at Apple for 15 years, and when you're at a company, you learn how to get things done the way that company gets things done. I honestly didn't see myself ever being able to achieve the CIO role at Apple. And so left really to flesh out my experience. It turned out to be a great move for me. I was there for 3 years. I'd say a really interesting learning from that. You know, I'd worked with Steve Jobs, this real icon, this figure, this personality larger than life, who got things done by, a lot of loud talk, maybe a lot of intimidation. He was really clear on the vision, and he wanted everybody to do it his way. And that was a way of leading. When I went to Nike, I got to work directly with Bill Knight, who was the founder of that organization and who led in a very different way. He included people in different ways. He was more quiet in getting his point across. He was more understated in making his point to people. And Nike was a company that wasn't afraid to kind of draw on human emotion. In fact, if you think back to some of the advertisements they had, you always felt something. And so I learned there are different ways to be successful that you can, and for me, that was an important learning because it said to me, I could go out, my job was to figure out who I was and what my way was and not to try to be somebody else. And I'd say that was for me the biggest takeaway from my period at Nike.
That's great. And you finally achieved, it wasn't just a Fortune 200 company that you became a CIO of. It was a Fortune 20 or 30, something like that. I don't know exactly in January 2000 where Cardinal Health would have been, but they were massive anyway. Can you talk a bit about that? And I'd love to also include as part of this, and maybe this also strays into your experience at Best Buy. In both of those, you also ran global shared services. And so a representation not only of your CIO responsibilities, but also the augmentation into adjacent areas as well. And I'd love for your comments on, how the role of the CIO then as now is expanding for those who are able to kind of drive a different kind of value from the post.
Cardinal Health was a fantastic opportunity for me. So I went there. I got a call from a recruiter asking me to come to Cardinal. It was a CIO opportunity, but I have to say I had really worked at Nike and at Apple and at General Electric. And so these are companies that people have heard about, that your family can talk about at the dinner table and they know who they are. I got a call about Cardinal Health. I had never heard of them. And they were in Columbus, Ohio. I had no idea where that was. From California, I was pretty sure I had flown over it, but I didn't know exactly where it was. And I was having trouble getting my family interested in going there and learning more about it. So eventually this persistent recruiter, who was great at this, called again. And I went out there and I spoke with them and I absolutely fell in love with this organization. And I was just telling you earlier, Peter, I love Columbus, Ohio still to this day. In fact, I'm a homeowner there now. So with the rest of my family there. But, Cardinal Health, I went there. It was a Fortune 65 company at that time and incredible story of growth. So this is an organization. I went into it. It was about a $35 billion organization. I left and it was about $100 billion revenue over a 10-year time frame. So this was sustained, rapid growth in its field. Some of it was organic, much of it by acquisition. We did integration of different companies. We divested parts of the company to become other publicly traded organizations. Some pieces were just sold off. I mean, I saw every facet of business that there was to see from that vantage point at Cardinal Health. So it was a wonderful experience for me to work among some incredibly talented people in this high growth organization that really had a mission around healthcare. So it was a great experience. And while I was there, I went in as the CIO of largest division and then was promoted to the global CIO a couple of years later. So, and then as the company grew, you're right, I did suddenly find myself as the CIO of a Fortune sort of 25 organization. So, I think so. What I brought to the table was some experience working in large organizations, which is a different skill than being successful in a smaller organization. And it just fit my particular skill set and my personality. And as the company was growing and trying to become more and more cost efficient, they were looking at different ways of, of making that happen. And one of the ways they wanted to do this was to create shared services from among all of the companies that had been acquired over the years. And so, taking services out of those companies, moving them into a centralized model. And as they looked at doing that, it became kind of a natural fit with what we did in IT. If you think about, IT service management, the way we speak and measure our performance in terms of service levels and cost per unit of service, this is exactly the same vocabulary that a business shared service would use. And so it became a pretty natural fit. And as we built out the shared services at Cardinal Health, they were put into the CIO organization. And we managed those as well, which was a really interesting expansion of the role for me at Cardinal. And then when I was recruited to Best Buy, it was really to take over the shared service role. And the CIO part was a little bit incremental to that. So it's just a different spin. But it was a really great realization that there's a natural synergy between the way IT people work and speak and measure performance and the way these services needed to be provided in the organization.
Fast forward now to today, you were the for nearly 2 years the global CIO of Pepsi. I wonder if you could take a moment to describe the organization that you found when you arrived in April of 2016. And some of the changes you enacted in the interim period, and would love to also understand a little bit of what's on your strategic roadmap now, the extent to which you can share that.
So PepsiCo recruited me about a year and a half ago. I've been here now that time and came into an organization that was largely, I'm going to use the word decentralized. There were some centrally provided services. Many of the services, though, were provided in our sectors, which are largely either a product-focused or a geographically-focused selling group. So as we, and I was given some pretty straightforward priorities to focus on when I first got here. We had some issues with system stability, which is in the IT world, kind of the cost of entry, right? You got to get that right. And so we, as I was assessing, what was the cause of all of this, right? You can fix them one problem at a time, but to have the kinds of issues we were experiencing, it meant there was something more systemic in the process. So we looked across the board and found that we could centralize a lot of some of the services we were providing. We went through an organizational remodel and restructure and did just that. And the results were dramatic. We've experienced almost a 95% improvement in service uptime this year over last year, just from getting really clear on roles and accountabilities and what we were going to measure and how we were going to measure it, the basics. So now that that battle is largely behind us, it gives us a better view of where we go from here. And I'd say just a preview of what we're focused on is about more standardization and more harmonization of the data. While we've got lots and lots of data in this organization, we think we could use it more effectively to make better decisions on behalf of both our customers and the consumers, the end consumers of our products. So we're focused on that. We're focused on, just trying to keep the cost model as efficient as we can while we do that. And most importantly, we're focused on helping to move our business forward in terms of, better engagement with our consumers, better opportunities for automation and digitalization. So, and we're right in the thick of all of these conversations with our businesses at PepsiCo. It's a really exciting time for us here.
That's wonderful. Can you talk a little bit about, as you've gotten to know the customer that you ultimately serve, how digitalization, as the case may be, is impacting them? It's interesting, some companies have, like, taken Apple, for example, the link is very obvious, But I'm curious how you see that translating into the customer experience for somebody who is a PepsiCo company.
Yeah, so our customers are, I mean, they, around our world, one thing I'm having a great time doing is learning more about our business around the world. So we've got just this incredible range of customers, right? From very, the largest, like Walmart, to, you know, what we would call traditional trade in India, where I was just a couple of weeks ago, which is a really small, family-owned operation. In what almost looks like a stall on the side of the road. So we've got to serve customers around the world. We're in over 200 countries around the world, and we're in very, very different kinds of markets that we serve. So putting solutions in place to serve all of them is, it's a really interesting and fun challenge, and obviously one size is not going to fit all. So the challenge here is to make sure we've got solutions in the hands of our, you know, we can modernize the solutions in the hands of the people who go see our customers so that they've got the right information to service that customer appropriately, make sure the orders are correct, make sure they have enough of what they want, especially during our peak selling season. Pretty basic stuff. We think the next frontier, though, is the consumer. And we're not exactly sure where, you know, the relationship with the consumer goes or ends up at this point, but we want to be positioned to be relevant when it becomes clearer how this all shakes out. And, you know, beyond that, I don't have the crystal ball that's going to tell us what that looks like, but I can tell you that we're doing some preparations for the time when that does start to, when clarity does start to emerge there.
I wanted to also ask you, you are a board-level CIO. You sit on the board of a North Carolina-based healthcare company called Premier Incorporated. And I wonder if you can talk a bit about how that opportunity presented itself to you, and also just more generally, what you see as the value of CIOs sitting on boards. It's still a relatively exclusive fraternity or sorority or club, more generally speaking, but thankfully one that is growing. And would love to understand what your experience has been.
It's a different kind of experience than being an operating executive for sure. I actually, again, I stated this objective, right? I had an objective or a goal for myself of getting a seat on a board. And to do that, everyone said to me, it's going to take you longer to get your first board than you think it should or than you think it will. And they were right. So, but the advice I got, which is the advice I still give others who ask me the question, is tell people about your intent. Tell people you want to be on a board. Talk to your recruiter network. Talk to your executive network. Talk to the network of people you have that may already serve on board, because that will be the way that you get pulled into a board opportunity. And so I actually was tapped on the shoulder for this opportunity at Premier through a recruiting firm. And the reason they wanted a CIO on the board is they're expanding their technology-based product suite. And they wanted somebody who was familiar with, you know, the cyber world, with the technology world, with the healthcare world. And I brought that experience from Cardinal Health. So it was a great match for me. And a really, really interesting opportunity, right? To see the workings of a company from that level. A very different experience than seeing it sitting inside the company as an operating executive.
Do you feel like the path that has been created by you and others who are now joining boards as CIOs, that this is logically going to continue and grow as time passes? Do you see this as a trend that has legs?
Absolutely, I do. I think a lot of companies begin to search for CIOs really because they're concerned about cyber. But there's so much more that a CIO brings to the table. You know, as an operating executive, the CIO is one of only a handful who actually have, you know, sort of the perspective of the entire organization. And it's a unique vantage point that the CIO has. Not just the perspective, but the kind of internal understanding of how the processes integrate and interrelate and don't interrelate. So there's that aspect that a CIO brings, right? It's an operating perspective that can translate to a board seat pretty well, and as well as the knowledge and the sort of comfort in the cybersecurity space that other board members don't yet have. And more and more of my CIO colleagues are acquiring board seats and really enjoying the experience.
Mm-hmm. And I wanted to also, before letting you go, ask you, are there certain trends as you look forward a few years that are particularly intriguing to you? And are there ways in which you and your team are beginning to test the waters of some of those trends to validate the whether or not they have an appropriate place at PepsiCo?
There's a lot going on out there, and we're constantly in search of what the next important trend is. I'd say right now I'm intrigued by a blockchain and what is it, what potential does it have for us, not just at PepsiCo, but in any kind of large corporation. And well, I'll leave it at that. Right now that's the one we're having a look at to understand a little bit more about.
That's great. Well, Jody Davids, thank you so much for joining us on the Forum on World Class IT. It's been a great conversation.
Awesome. Thanks so much for having me, Peter.
Thanks for listening to the Forum on World Class IT. If you like what you've heard, please rate us on iTunes or through whatever other source you use for podcasts. And please join me next week when my guest will be Taavi Kotka, the former CIO of the country of Estonia.
You've just listened to a podcast in a series we call MetaStrategies Forum on World Class IT. If you like what you've heard, please consider reading my book, World Class IT, Why Businesses Succeed When IT Triumphs, published by Josie Bass, a division of Wiley Press, in December of 2009. Both the book and the Forum on World Class IT offer stories from a wide range of top IT leaders relating to MetaStrategy's five principles of world class IT. The five principles are as follows. Principle one is people, and it's really the foundational principle. Without the right people doing the right jobs at the right time, it'll be nearly impossible to achieve excellent performance. The second principle is infrastructure. We like to say that this is the principle that separates proactive organizations from reactive ones. If infrastructure is not reliably performing its tasks, the IT organization will become stuck in reactive mode, consistently fighting fires. If systems and hardware and networks and so on work reliably, then a larger portion of the organization can think about the future. The third principle is project and portfolio management. This is the engine through which new capabilities can be brought to bear on behalf of the company. It is important to ensure that projects are delivered on time, on budget, and on target, and that the portfolio collectively supports the objectives of the business. The fourth principle is IT and business partnerships. It's important that, first and foremost, the different parts of IT, from business analysis to development and QA, through to support and all other aspects of IT, communicate effectively and efficiently. It's equally important, then, that IT develop a partnering relationship with the business that it is a part of. If the three prior principles are done well, then IT should earn a place at the strategy setting table, driving different parts of the business strategy. The fifth and last principle is external partnerships. Outsourcing is becoming a crucial weapon that organizations are employing, and managing these relationships to ensure that value is achieved is critical. In the fourth principle, the organization has learned and contributed to the discussion about what is strategic and what is not. Once that's clear, then it will be easier to determine which aspects of IT might be better managed by external partners or vendors. For more information on these five principles and the sub-principles that are associated with each, please visit our website at www.metastrategy.com, and please share your thoughts and comments by contacting us at feedback@metastrategy.com. And our theme music was written by David Armin. I'm Peter High. Thanks for listening.